From the Brennan Center for Justice, I'm Victoria Bassetti, and this is The Line.
How did it make you feel to watch your grandmother counting money to pay poll taxes?
Really angry.
Did you think it was fair?
No, I didn't think she'd have to pay to vote.
We barred the poll tax in 1964 with a constitutional amendment. And in the wake of the civil rights movement of the 1960s and the youthquake of the 1970s, it seemed like we had finally smashed all of the barriers to voting. But today, in the name of reducing voter fraud, several states have adopted new restrictive voter identification laws. These laws effectively force many citizens to pay to get the ID they need to vote. And as they struggle to do so, their vote often gets lost. This election, these laws may block many citizens from exercising their right to vote at all. If you thought barriers like the poll tax were a relic of the past in America, you might want to think again. To look closely at the real impact of strict voter ID laws, I'm here with Wendy Weiser, who's the director of the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Victoria. Nice to see you.
So take a listen to this.
I think as far as opportunities for fraud, I guess being on the inside, I know what a myth that is, because even if there's a dead name on the list, it's a long leap between that and having somebody actually use that dead person's name because they somehow uncovered the fact that they were still on the list and coming in and voting for them.
So when you think about the 1.7 million votes that are probably going to be cast in Connecticut this November,
right,
more or less 1.7
yes.
million,
right,
how many of those do you think are going to be fraudulent?
None.
Really?
Oh, yes. No, we actually have looked very carefully into these records. We have had two reported cases of in-person voter fraud, which is what we're talking about, someone actually impersonating someone.
That's Denise Merrill, Secretary of State for Connecticut. John Fund is a columnist for the National Review and a former member of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. He sees voter ID very differently. Here's what he said during a League of Women Voters panel I moderated in Merrill's home state of Connecticut.
If you go down this road 40 miles to New York City, they have one of the finest investigative units in the country called the New York City Department of Investigations. In 2013, when New York had its mayor's race, they decided to have a test of the Board of Elections in New York City. They sent out investigators to vote in the names of 63 people at the polls, not absentee ballots, at the polls. These were people who were either dead, moved out of state, or sitting in jail. A 21-year-old Puerto Rican investigator would try to vote in the name of an 87-year-old Polish immigrant. So, I mean, they tried as many preposterous scenarios as you could imagine. Of the 63 tries, 61 were successful. 61. The only two failures were one person in Staten Island was told, you're at the wrong polling place. You should be at the polling place down the street. I'll walk you out the door and show you where to go. The last failure, the only other failure was somebody showed up and the polling worker said to the voter, the investigator, I can't let you vote. You're trying to vote in the name of my son, and he's in jail. Now, my simple point is this. How do you know how much in-person voter fraud there is if it's the perfect crime, and the only way you can find out is if someone confesses? They're literally right now, if you don't have an ID or other system, you can walk in and vote in anyone else's name. If you do it properly, and it's very easy to do it properly, there's almost zero chance of ever getting caught. And therefore, we don't know how much there is out there, which is why voter ID is a simple, practical way of trying to curb a problem that could be larger than we think.
John Fund of the National Review.
So, Wendy, what's going on here? We've got one person saying no fraud, and we've got another person saying it's the perfect crime and it's happening all over the place.
Well, what Secretary Merrill said is consistent with what we've heard not only from election officials across the country, but from every single study and investigation into voter fraud in this country over the last two decades, and from multiple court decisions also looking into the issue. There is some small amount of polling place voter fraud, but that amount is minuscule. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals found that in Texas, out of 20 million votes cast from 2000 to 2012, there were only two that were involved in-person voter fraud. Justin Levitt, professor at Loyola Law School, did a study of all elections from 2000 to 2014 and found only 31 credible cases across the country out of a billion votes cast. This is something that everybody agrees, and we're actually seeing an increasing bipartisan consensus on this point, is not a serious threat to our elections.
Still, when you pick up the newspaper or listen to the news, a lot of people are talking about these state voter ID laws. So what is a state voter ID law? What does that mean when you hear about that in the news?
The controversy over voter ID is not actually about whether or not voters should have to show some form of identification or otherwise identify themselves over the polls. What the controversy is over new strict photo ID laws that have been pushed in states across the country in recent years. Until recently, every state had some form of identification requirement. Most states require all voters to show some form of ID, but they're flexible requirements and reasonable.
So like
what to show.
An employer ID.
A student ID, a federal employee ID, a driver's license.
A utility bill.
Yeah, and some allow for forms of non-photo ID, like utility bills, government paychecks. But what we've seen in recent years is a push to make ID requirements stricter and stricter and narrow the list of IDs to forms of ID that many Americans do not have, to a much smaller list of IDs. And there have been controversial cherry-picking going on. So in Texas, for example. There's a lot of controversy over the fact that the state allowed people to show their concealed carry license as an acceptable form of ID for voting, but not their state-issued student ID card.
How many states in this upcoming election in 2016 have strict photo ID laws in place?
In 2016, we will now have 8 states that will have strict photo ID laws in place, and this is a sharp increase. In 2004, there were 0 states. So beforehand, this was not a requirement for voting in the United States.
And in addition, there are a bunch of other states that have strict voter ID laws, but they haven't been put into effect because they're pending court cases. Is that right?
So there are a number of states that passed strict photo ID laws that had those laws struck down by courts. This year, we saw courts strike down strict photo ID laws in both Texas and in North Dakota. And there were also a number of court decisions that prompted states to soften voter ID laws. In North Carolina, the state actually repealed a strict voter ID law and replaced it with something less onerous in response to litigation.
This is impacting millions of voters, right?
Absolutely. Millions of voters now will have to show these narrow forms of ID. Millions more will unfortunately be under the mistaken belief that they're required to show ID, and that's something that we're worried about. And unfortunately, we know that roughly 10-11% of voting age American citizens do not have the kinds of ID that are required of these new strict photo ID laws. The number for certain groups of voters, like African Americans, younger voters under age 24, for example, are much higher. 25% in one study of African American voters don't have IDs that are required by these new laws. And let's be clear, nobody is raising objections to asking voters to show some form of ID. It's the fact that the laws have been so narrowly circumscribed to sharply limit what kinds of IDs voters can show and to have no other way that voters can cast a ballot that will count after demonstrating they are who they say they are.
Let me have you listen to a clip from a conversation I had with Michael Brandy. He heads up elections enforcement for the state of Connecticut.
Let's say I'm really worried about the election and I've decided I'm going to do it. I'm going to vote 10 times on election day. Walk me through it. How would I do that? What would step one be if I wanted to vote 10 times in Connecticut?
The truth is you wouldn't be able to vote 10 times. When you appear at the polling place, you've already registered to vote, so you're on the voting rolls. When you show up at the polling place, you're going to be asked to provide some form of identification. Not photo ID, but some form of identification. If you have nothing with you at all, Connecticut has a process where you could fill out an affidavit, and through that affidavit, you'd be given a ballot. Now, it's a provisional ballot at that point because they have to certify that you are, in fact, the person and you are voting in the right district, and it's you on the voter rolls. To show up and try to impersonate somebody, I'm just not sure how you would do that. You are still required to give some type of identification. It could be a phone bill. It could be your electric bill with your a credit card with your signature on it. It's usually multiple kinds of identification that you need to provide to verify that the person that's on the voter rolls is you.
Now, so if I wanted to do it, I suppose the first thing I need to do is find the names of some other registered people. Mm-hmm. And I'd also have to be reasonably certain that they weren't themselves going to show up that day.
Right. So you have to make sure they're not already there to vote. And you're also going to have to somehow acquire some type of identification to show that Jane Doe, who lives at 23 Smith Street, you have some form of identification, whether it's your utility bills that you've somehow had to acquire. It would be a real process to try to engage and steal one vote. And that's probably the reason.
And then if you caught me, what would you do to me?
If we caught you, you would be subject to the criminal violations of voter fraud. Under 9-360, fraudulent voting would subject you to a fine of somewhere between $300 and $500 and a jail sentence of between 1 and 2 years. To risk that, to vote for one person and impersonate one person, doesn't seem to me to be a great – the cost-benefit there doesn't seem to match up.
So why all of this push for strict voter ID that you hear about across the United States?
Great question. Looking in the state of Connecticut, we're just simply not seeing these types of voter impersonation situations. We don't know why a photo ID would be required. To me, it's the proverbial solution in search of a problem here. And it's something that would be more akin to voter suppression here than it would be preventing fraud.
Michael Brandy, Executive Director of Connecticut's Election Enforcement Commission. So Connecticut is a state that doesn't have strict voter ID.
Seems like not a lot of risk of in-person voter impersonation there.
And I think that that's what the evidence shows across the country. This kind of voter impersonation just doesn't happen. It's an incredibly stupid and an inefficient way to try to steal an election. For the individual involved, the risk is so incredibly high, and the cost of getting caught is 5 years in prison and $10,000 in fines. And the benefit is very, very small, only one marginal additional vote for your preferred candidate. And if you really want to do this in a wholesale way, so you can actually have enough votes to impact an election, you need to get thousands and thousands of people to engage in this activity as well, or perhaps hundreds if you're trying to swing a local election. And your risk of getting caught increases exponentially, as does the cost of your fraud. And so it's no wonder this doesn't happen. And this was very well encapsulated in a recent opinion by Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Richard Posner, who's actually a very well-respected conservative jurist, who said, "Think of how much it would cost to orchestrate an effective voter impersonation fraud, given the number of voters who must be bribed and amounts generous enough to overcome their fear of being detected." This is really something that does not make sense as a way of trying to steal an election.
But now, the flip side of this, though, is if a state does impose a strict voter ID requirement, it has really demonstrable impact on people. Tell me about how many people are going to not be able to vote or are going to be inhibited from voting because of these laws that have been imposed.
Well, there's actually growing evidence that these strict voter ID laws are not only a barrier to people participating, but they're actually resulting in reduced turnout. In both Kansas and Tennessee, the Government Accountability Office actually found that in 2012, their strict voter ID laws decreased overall turnout in those states by 2-3%. And the negative turnout impact among certain groups of voters who are less likely to have these forms of IDs is much higher. More than 10% for Latino voters, for example, was found in a recent study by the University of California at San Diego. A growing number of courts are also pointing out that these strict voter ID laws have a really harmful effect on the electorate. In Texas, for example, the federal court found that 608,000 registered Texas voters did not have the kinds of IDs that were required by the Texas ID law. That law is now blocked. And 1.2 million eligible voters, that's 1.2 million Texans who would be blocked from being able to participate unless they were able to obtain one of these forms of ID.
I mean, we've already got not enough participation in our elections. I'd like you to listen to this clip from Judith Brown Dianis, who is the head of the Advancement Project and a civil rights lawyer.
So the voter ID provision, you know, and this is what folks need to understand. People often think, oh, it's voter ID. It's, you know, photo ID. Everybody has photo ID. Not true. There are a lot of Americans. In fact, the Brennan Center came up with a number for that, 21 million Americans that don't have voter ID. There are people like one of our plaintiffs who didn't have a birth certificate, especially for some elderly African Americans, especially in southern states who weren't born in a hospital or were born in a segregated hospital that no longer exists. Those folks don't have access to birth certificates. What about if you were born at home by a midwife, you know, and then you have people who have gotten married. I mean, in Missouri, we represented someone in a voter ID case where the person had gotten married and her name wasn't what was on her birth certificate and she didn't have her marriage certificate. She'd been married for, you know, over 30 years. And so, you know, these extra hurdles that it takes, and, you know, it is what we consider to be a modern day poll tax, because you then have to go pay for, even though these states will make the ID free, you have to pay for the underlying documents. And sometimes for people, they actually don't either have the money for those underlying documents or they actually can't get their hands on it. So, and at the end of the day, we really have to look at the reason. Why are we doing this? There was no voter fraud. Right? There's case after case in these voter ID cases where no one has proved up that they actually were solving some problem.
One of the other pernicious impacts of these strict voter ID laws is their disproportionate impact on communities of color. And we know that African Americans and Latinos are much less likely than white voters to have the kinds of photo ID that are required by the strict photo ID laws. And we found more and more courts have also found that these strict photo ID laws are actually passed with the intent of making it harder for African Americans and Latinos to participate in the election process.
One of the cases the Brennan Center and Wendy Weiser have worked on was the successful but still ongoing challenge to the stringent voter ID law in Texas. In the course of preparing that legal challenge, the Brennan Center gathered some remarkable testimony from a woman named Sammy Louise Bates. Bates grew up in Mississippi in the 1940s. She remembers poll taxes, which were banned in 1964 by an amendment to the United States Constitution.
Is it important to you to be able to vote?
Yes.
And why is that, Ms. Bates?
I think it's important. My opinion, what I think about things that's going on, is known.
Do you remember a time when some states imposed poll taxes?
Yes, I do. I remember when I was a child in Mississippi, I used to be the one that helped my grandmother to count out what she had to take to the polls to pay her poll taxes, because I was the only one in the house then that was going to school.
How did it make you feel to watch your grandmother counting money to pay poll taxes?
Really angry.
Did you think it was fair?
No, I didn't think you should have to pay to vote.
Do you think you should have to pay to vote today?
No. My living and being a citizen of the state, I think they give me a right to vote.
Sammy Louise Bates, in testimony she gave for the case challenging the restrictive voter ID law in Texas. Wendy Weiser from the Brennan Center for Justice worked on that case.
In Texas, the court found that African Americans and Latinos were 2 to 3 times less likely than white voters to have the kinds of ID that were required by that state's voter ID law. There were similar findings in Wisconsin and in other states as well. So courts are finding that they're actually not only reducing participation, not justified, but they're actually discriminatory.
The strict voter ID law in Texas affected Sammy Louise Bates one more way. In order to get a form of ID that would be considered valid under the law, she needed to get a copy of her old birth certificate. But that took time and money, money that she didn't have.
When you're getting a certain amount of money, you're going to put the money where you feel the need is most urgent at the time. And I think my kitchen was a little bit more important right at that time than a birth certificate.
Feeding your family was more important.
Yes, I had to put $42 where it was doing the most good. It was feeding my family because we couldn't eat the birth certificate, that's for sure. And we couldn't pay rent with the birth certificate.
So I'm going to confess something personally to you. I once let my driver's license expire, and it took me 6 months to get it renewed. I was really lucky because I happened to still have a passport. But I had to go try to find my Social Security card. I didn't have one, so I had to get a new one issued. It was from New Orleans. It took a lot of time. It took a lot of money. 6 months. You know, I'm an upper middle class white woman with a flexible job. Plenty of time that I could go get one. I really have to say, I wonder the impact that this sort of requirement has on communities that don't have as much time or as much money or flexibility as I had when something like that happened to me.
The kinds of story that you're telling and that Judy is telling is increasingly the kinds of stories that are coming to light and that are calling into question the wisdom of these ID requirements. Courts more and more have been taking a real close look at how they are functioning in practice and are finding that there are hundreds of variations and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in each state that are having different variations of these kinds of problems that you're talking about. For some people, their birth certificate wasn't issued. For some people, all their documentation is in their maiden name. For some people, they can't afford the underlying documentation, or there's no transportation to take them to the ID issuing office. And the net result is we have lots of people for whom it's really hard to comply with these ID requirements.
Still, you hear people say things like, well, you have to have a photo ID to get on a plane, to enter a building, to go to Blockbuster, even though Blockbuster doesn't exist anymore. But you hear people saying that sort of thing.
It's not actually an absolute barrier to any of these things. I'll tell you my own personal story. I had my driver's license expire when I was traveling to Washington, D.C. And I didn't discover that until the return leg of the flight when they didn't accept my ID as an appropriate ID to board an airplane. But they put me through an alternative screening process. That's what the TSA has. If you don't have a valid photo ID, they actually have some process that you can go through, prove your identity, and still board the airplane. I made it home in time for my children's bedtime and went through that extra screening process. And we have a lot of states, like Connecticut was describing, that have an extra screening process for voters that don't have ID, but still allow them to vote a ballot that counts.
And flying isn't a constitutional right either.
Flying is not a constitutional right.
So you've been fighting these laws for a long time. You've been filing lawsuits. You've been getting people to testify against it. You feel like you're winning?
I think the tide has definitely been in the direction of the voters, and we have been winning more and more cases challenging these really strict voter ID laws. When the laws have been less strict and more flexible, and voters had more options for being able to participate in the voting process, courts have been less inclined to strike down and block those laws. But ultimately, the issue is not resolved. The lawsuits are still ongoing. The U.S. Supreme Court has perhaps suggested an interest and willingness to consider this issue sometime in the future again. And so I expect we're in store for an ultimate showdown on these laws before the U.S. Supreme Court.
Wendy Weiser. She directs the Democracy Program at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. Thanks for joining us for this edition of The Line. Visit us at BrennanCenter.org for more about the critical issues of voting rights in these elections. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast to get all of our future episodes as soon as they're released. For the Brennan Center for Justice, I'm Victoria Bassetti.